Welcome to Modular March. I'm Andy, this is Robbie, and we are The Roll-Up.
Modular March is an educational experience about all things modular. Enjoy.
Back to Modular March. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Ellie Davidson from Espresso to learn about based espresso, not the coffee. In this case, we're talking about ad hoc shared sequencing. Ellie, welcome, and it's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Thanks. Let's dive in.
All right. Yeah. So I'm Ellie. I am the lead researcher and also an engineer at Espresso Systems. And today we're going to talk about based espresso, which is this recent evolution of the espresso design that I think is really, really neat. So I'll go ahead and jump in. So to start off with, espresso is a shared sequencer. And I just want to level the field by saying, what is shared sequencing? Well, it has two parts. So the first is you have some sort of proposer assignment. And this is basically just deciding who actually gets the rights to order transactions. So in Ethereum, the Ethereum proposer is the one who actually gets to order transactions. Maybe they outsource that to a builder or maybe not, but this is like the same idea here. And then you have a second part, which is some sort of finality gadget. And basically this finality gadget just confirms that, once the transactions are ordered, the ordering cannot change. So in Ethereum, this is Ethereum finality, which happens after like 15 minutes. So this is kind of the general gist. And then today I'm going to kind of dive into each one and explain kind of how Espresso is thinking about doing these. The majority of the discussion is going to be on the first one, but we'll touch on the second one as well. So this is very familiar, but kind of wanted to go over like what the problem space is. So we have rollups and they're great. They horizontally scale Ethereum. You can get more transactions per second. They're really good. They also allow different VMs. So, you can do custom things. You can have niche VMs that are maybe better suited for things than the standard EVM. And this is all really great. But you have a couple of drawbacks. And this is why we have made shared sequencers. So the first drawback, or the main drawback, is that interoperability between rollups is quite hard. So if you want to have a transaction across two different rollups, you essentially have to go back all the way to Ethereum. You need to wait for Ethereum finality, which takes a long time, and it's just a very bad user experience, and it's very slow. So what we want is to be able to have what's called atomic execution, which is where you can have two transactions or as many transactions as you want across as many different rollups, and you're guaranteed that they either all succeed or they all fail. This is what we want. So if we look at the job of a sequencer, as I said before, a lot of the times a sequencer is also termed the proposer. They're kind of the same thing. The sequencer gets to decide the order of transaction. So basically they're deciding the rollup block for each rollup. There's a couple of other things that they can do. So they can also maybe save users on gas cost by waiting to post data to Ethereum. That's a minor improvement. But another big thing they can do is offer pre-confirmations, which pre-confirmations, that's like my favorite topic currently in the space, and it could be its entire like own talk. But pre-confirmations are really powerful because they give users a really good promise that their transaction is going to be final. So when you think about Ethereum, I as a user don't really want to wait 15 minutes for every single transaction I do on Ethereum. So this is where pre-confirmations come in. Today, rollups give these really fast pre-confirmations. And as a user, if I'm interacting with a rollup today, basically in a few 100 milliseconds or so, I can get a pre-confirmation that's really strong. And I know my transaction is very, very likely going to be finalized on Ethereum. And here, you know, maybe the sequencer, the proposer runs an auction to decide the sequence of the block. That's just kind of an added little note. But now let's dive into the shared sequencer architecture. That's Espresso. So the most basic shared sequencer is actually Ethereum itself. And so this is what's called based sequencing. And this is where you use Ethereum to sequence for rollups. Basically, the way that this works is that users send their transactions directly to Ethereum. Ethereum proposers put them into blobs and propose them. This is really great because you get all of the security and decentralization of Ethereum. You can get really good interoperability. So because one Ethereum proposer can be sequencing for multiple rollups at once, they can make sure that atomic transactions across rollups work. So this is quite good. But you could actually go even further, and you can do, so this is what Espresso is doing, where you add this like layer 1.5 in the middle. And it might not be entirely clear why you want this layer, but I'll explain as we go on why potentially having this layer 1.5 between the layer 2s and the layer 1 can give you some really cool benefits. So the main that was kind of an introduction to shared sequencing and what it's trying to do. So now I'm going to really dive into the first big part of Espresso's design, which is a lottery that allows us to redistribute revenue from sequencing back to rollups. So the problem is that shared sequencing is great. You get this really good interoperability, but the person or the entity who's actually deciding the order of transactions is the one that gets all of the revenue. They get both, you know, transaction fees for sequencing, but they also can get MEV. And the idea is that interoperability is great, but rollups aren't going to want to use any shared sequencer, even, you know, Ethereum L1 as a shared sequencer, if they're losing all of their revenue. So this is the idea Espresso has to solve that problem. So basically, it's a lottery, but first we're going to describe it as an auction, and then we'll add on the lottery aspect a bit later. So the idea is that you have all of these different rollups, and they're all being sequenced across this shared sequencing layer. This could be Espresso, this could be another shared sequencer, this could be the Ethereum L1, any shared sequencer. And so what you're going to do is you run an auction to decide who gets the rights to propose. So for example, in Ethereum today, it's just kind of a randomly selected who's going to propose in Ethereum. But you may have heard of this idea called execution tickets. And this is very similar to execution tickets in Ethereum. It's slightly different, but similar. And the idea is that instead of having your validators of the network just randomly get proposing rights for free, instead, you have people bid for the right to become a proposer. So this is what we're going to do here. And the difference here is, compared to maybe what's happening today, is that instead of running an auction for only each single rollup, you're going to run an auction for all of the rollups together. So this allows the person that wins the auction, they can facilitate all of this interoperability. So since they're sequencing for more than one rollup at a time, they can make sure that the atomic transactions between rollups actually work and are valid. So this is what we're going to do here. So one analogy, or before I go into this, maybe the question though is, so we have this shared auction and that's really great, but the main point of this is that we wanted to distribute revenue back to the rollups. And the question is, well, how do you decide how much each rollup is worth? Obviously it wouldn't really make sense if you just give each rollup a flat, you know, you say, okay, I have 10 rollups, I'm just going to split the revenue, you know, by 10. That doesn't really make sense because some rollups are going to generate more revenue than others. So this is kind of the big question. And an analogy to this is like bands playing at a music festival. You have one music festival, you have a lot of bands. The different, you know, different bands are going to bring in more tickets versus other bands. So how do you decide how much revenue, you know, to give back? So this is the problem that we're trying to solve, is how do we decide how much revenue to give back to rollups? So,
and how do you keep them all happy?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we're going to do a first attempt, and then we'll build on this. So the first attempt is that you have two options, is that you can either, if I want to, you know, be the proposer for rollups, I can either propose or bid to propose for all of them at once or only each one of them individually. So obviously, if you're only sequencing for each rollup individually, you don't get any interoperability. That's like the case that it is today. But you can also bid for all of them at once. So this is really good. The key point here is that you can take the bids for the individual rollup. So and you can use that to calculate how much the rollup is worth. So for example, let's say someone bids $10 for rollup A, $20 for rollup B to sequence them individually, not together. Well, then when you sequence them all together, you can use those individual bids to say, okay, well, B is worth, generates more revenue than A, so I should give B a higher percentage of the revenue back. This is the first idea. But you have this problem called shill bidding, which is basically, well, the rollup wants to make as much money as possible, obviously. So it's just going to artificially inflate its bid. So if it knows that someone is going to win the right to sequence all of the rollups at once, but that their revenue is based on how much people bid for them individually, a rollup is just going to say, well, I'm going to bid a huge amount for myself. And then I get, you know, I can get a huge amount of MEV back. And this is bad, obviously, because this isn't efficiently reallocating the revenue back to rollups based on their true value. So what do we do? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to allow this combinatorial auction where instead of just having the option to buy the sequencing rights for all of the rollups or only in one individual run, one, you can buy the sequencing rights for any combination of rollups. So for example, here in this picture, we have all of the rollups, we have the rollups individually, or we have this bundle too that only consists of three rollups. And the idea here is that you're going to choose the combination of rollups that has the highest bids among all of them. So if someone bids $20 to sequence all of the rollups together, and each rollup is only individually gets a bid of $1, well, then obviously sequencing them all together is going to win. But you go back to this shill bidding problem and you say, okay, let's say rollups A, B, C, D, and E are each only actually worth $1. But rollup A says, well, I want a ton of revenue, so I'm going to bid $20 on myself. Well, now, instead of everybody losing out, you can now exclude rollup A from the shared bundle. So basically, you would end up with a bundle that has B, C, D, and E, and then rollup A is sequenced by itself. So we run this combinant. Oh, go ahead.
No, I just have
I got a quick question.
Yeah, you go ahead, Rob.
So, like, one of these rollups shill bidding will increase the percent revenue that they would generate from the sequencer choosing their bid, but they would also be paying more. So do those two things cancel out?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the idea is that if a rollup itself is shill bidding on itself, it's not really paying anything because it's essentially just paying itself to sequence. So they don't actually end up canceling out.
Got it. Okay.
And then I understand that we wish that the whole world is good actors and that everyone's just going to do the right thing. But unfortunately, this is the crypto economic incentive mechanisms, which we have to design, because frankly, that is not the world which we exist in as much as we'd hope. But if each of the rollups, or if there was some collusion where there was this continuous shill bidding across the entire bundle, meaning every rollup basically had a shill bidder, whether it be themselves or a separate entity, would that cancel out where it would just be this inflated amount across the board, but the proportional revenues would for each individual rollup would then effectively be the same percentage regardless of like the notional value or the dollar value?
I see. Yeah. So I think in the situation that you describe, let's say you have rollups that are colluding to artificially inflate their bids. Well, the thing is, if they inflate their bids too much that they actually win the auction, then they actually need to sequence and they actually need to pay that bid. So let's say you're rollup A and you're colluding with B and C and you're going to submit a really high bid for the bundle A, B, and C because you want more, a higher revenue. But if you submit too high of a bundle, you will actually win that. And now you need to pay your amount. Like you need, if I bid $20, I need to pay $20. And you might not actually make $20 from sequencing that. So now you're out of money. So that's kind of like the control, I guess, is that you don't ever want to bid more than the money you can actually make from sequencing, because then you're losing money. All right, so yeah, we have this auction that we're running over any combination of bundles. And the idea is that, kind of like you were saying, is if one rollup decides that they're going to shill bid and artificially inflate their price, then they're actually going to have to pay that price. And they may not actually make that much. They may not make all of that back by sequencing. So this is pretty good. But let's take it a step further and actually say, well, maybe shill bidding isn't terrible. So shill bidding isn't a perfect solution, but why might rollups want to shill bid on themselves? Well, it might be because they want to make sure that they definitely make a specific amount of revenue. So let's say, you know, they say, I don't want to actually give anybody else the rights to sequence for my rollup unless I'm making like at least more than I make sequencing by myself. So we can view shill bidding as basically this reserve price that rollups can set that basically ensures that they either get to sequence for themselves, or if they don't sequence for themselves, then they're making more money than they would otherwise. So a couple of caveats on this whole idea is that, well, I said we're running a combinatorial auction. And when you think about that, that can really easily explode into the number of bundles that are possible. It's manageable with like 5 rollups on the system, but if you have 1,000 rollups, you have way too many combinations to realistically deal with. And then the problem becomes, well, how do you actually do this optimization to find which combination of rollups gives you the maximizing amount of revenue? Well, the solution to that is that you can just find a good one, and then you can kind of have this like short challenge period of maybe, you know, relatively short, you know, maybe within 30 minutes or so, and then someone can submit a better one if they find it. So this is a way to make this combinatorial problem probably more tractable. The other part is that realistically, people aren't going to be bidding on every single combination possible. There's going to be combinations that just don't make a lot of sense. So your number of practical bids that you're getting in the system will be much smaller than the total space of all possible rollup combinations. So the second big part of this is that you have to run this ahead of time. So this is different than like proposer builder separation today, where the auction is run just in time, right before the block has to be submitted to the network. This is run far ahead in advance. And this is for good reason. So there's a few reasons you might want to do this. A big one is that it can kind of smooth the expected value. So when you look at PBS today, the MEV is like really spiky. And if you run the auction far ahead of time, then people who bid have to bid on the expected value, which is much flatter. So this is kind of in the execution tickets post that on ETH Research, they kind of discuss like why this might be a good thing to have people bid on expected value rather than this very spiky MEV value.
And Ellie, real quick, yeah, if you don't mind. So that auction would basically begin as soon as the pre-confirmations of each of those rollups were, you know, hit the network or hit the sequencer effectively, or as soon as those transactions hit, like when would that auction begin?
Yeah, that's a good question. It would actually happen before that. So if I'm a user and I'm submitting a transaction, at that point, the person who's sequencing my transaction should already be known. So this basically would be run practically probably like a half an hour in advance of when it's your turn to propose. So in terms of Ethereum, this would be like you're running it several epochs in advance. And yeah, the whole point of it is that when someone bids to propose a block, the whole point is that they have no idea which transactions are going to be included in it. So yeah, that's a really good question. This happens quite far in advance, like 30 minutes or more in advance. Go ahead.
Sorry, was just one quick follow-up there. How do they how do they price their bid that they're going to make to sequence that block if they don't have an idea of which transactions are going to be included?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I imagine that there's probably a lot more research that could be done into this, but what I think will happen is that these people who are bidding would be similar to like builders and PBS today. So they kind of know roughly what they make over time. So even though they won't know what they make in that specific block that they're sequencing for, they can say, well, on average, every week I make X amount being a builder for PBS. So I'll bid proportionally to that of what I expect to make. But the kind of the whole point of it, though, is that they don't know exactly what they'll make. But you could say then this goes into my next point, where if you don't know exactly how much you're going to make and you're bidding on this expected value, that expected value doesn't change. So you're just going to bid the same thing for every single slot. And what's going to end up is that then you just have the same person who wins every single slot. And then we have really centralized block building and this whole problem that we're trying to avoid. So this is why we're actually going to run a lottery instead of an auction. And this introduces some amount of randomness into the system to help decentralize this, so we don't end up with the same person proposing for all of the blocks. And the rough idea of what the lottery is basically, it's the same thing as execution tickets in Ethereum. You sell these tickets, their tickets are priced accordingly. If all of the tickets get sold for some slot, then you raise the price the next round. If very few tickets get sold, you lower the price. And once people bid, they submit their bid. Their bid is associated with these lottery tickets. So instead of bidding an exact amount, you essentially just buy however many lottery tickets you want. So let's say I think that I can make $20 by sequencing for some combination of rollups. So I'm going to buy lottery tickets that are worth $19, let's say. And then that gives me like a $1 profit margin. And then these lottery tickets, as the name implies, are just randomly selected. So the whole point of this is that this forces decentralization among the people who actually win the rights to sequence.
Nice. Just have a question on the graphic. It says builder with most tickets has only like blank percent chance to win. I assume that there's some sort of like mechanism in which I mean, there's a cap on the total tickets available. Right. But what about how does the builder, is that how the builder is going to have a limited percent or like, yeah, how does that work? Like, what does that mean?
So the percentage is, like you were saying, it's the amount of tickets that you buy. So if each ticket, you have the same chance to win. So if there's 100 tickets and I buy 20 of them, then I have like a 20% chance to win this auction. Well, then you ask, well, why would you decide to buy only 20 versus buying all 100 or, 50? And that depends on your expected value. So basically what will happen is that if I think that I can make $100, or like actually a better example would be, let's say I can make $50 sequencing for a block. One of my options could be I could buy 50 tickets then, and out of 100 tickets. And this gives me a 50% chance of winning. But this actually means I'll lose money because I'm only going to win every other time. And so if you average it out, I'm actually only making $25 per slot because I'm losing every other slot. So instead, you would alter how many tickets you buy to take into account this randomness percentage. So you say, okay, if I can make $50 sequencing, then I'm only going to buy as many tickets that allows me to make $50, including the chances that I might lose, like not win the right to actually sequence. So that's what that part means.
There's a loss associated by losing the auction or by losing the lottery. You, it says that the tickets are refunded slash canceled. Does that mean that, like, what's the loss? Is it a loss or is it a ref? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is a good point. So there's these different bundles that you're bidding on, right? So if you're bidding on a bundle that ends up winning, so let's say the bundle for rollups A, B, and C wins, even if you don't win the lottery for that bundle, you still have to pay for it. So this is something that I don't think is clear from the slides. But if you bid on a bundle, say only A and B, and that combination never won, then you get refunded. In practice, you can actually get refunded. In practice, you just probably won't pay for it at all. So in practice, like, you submit a bid promising, or you submit a lottery ticket, maybe promising to pay in the future. But then, yeah, if your combination doesn't win, you get refunded. So, but that's a key important point, is that if you buy lottery tickets for a bundle that does win, you still have to pay, which is how we get.
So you win and you still lose. Wait, you were saying, which is how we get to?
Oh, which is how we get to the true expected value. So for example, if a rollup is worth, like, let's say sequencing for rollups A, B, and C is worth $20, and someone who only bought 10 lottery tickets happens to win the lottery, well, you don't want to refund everybody else, because then you only generated $10 worth of revenue. And how can you give $20 back worth of revenue when you only generated 10? So that's why if someone buys lottery tickets for a winning bundle, but they don't actually win the rights, they still need to pay, because you still need to capture the total value of the bundle.
And that would be if someone else offers on A, B, and C, but not as much as the person who offers the most on that combination?
Yeah, right. So the way it works in the lottery is basically all the lottery tickets are some price, and the combination that has the most amount of tickets sold for it would be the winning one.
Okay. And then out of the people who submit on that combination of roll-ups, only one person is going to bid the most for that combination. So even though you picked the right combination, you didn't bid enough on that combination, so you would lose.
This is the difference between the auction and the lottery. So in the auction model, yes, what you said is right. In the lottery model, instead of who bids the most, it's a random chance of drawing your ticket. And if you want to bid the most, you buy more tickets.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what is the mechanism? Like, what is the randomized mechanism? Like, in lotteries, you know, you have this a bunch of balls and a big like grate, and then they're like spinning the thing, and then someone like sticks their hand in, and like that's the randomized function. Mm-hmm. Like, what is like the element of randomness that chooses the winning ticket?
This is a really good question. So this is something that we haven't set in stone yet in our design, but likely we would be using a similar thing to Ethereum. So how Ethereum randomly chooses who's going to propose, they have some random beacon. We would probably use that as well, but adjust it accordingly so that it works for this use case. But the important thing about it is that it's a verifiable random beacon. So this is what Ethereum has, where it doesn't matter who actually runs the lottery and decides who wins, as long as someone else can verify that it is actually the correct, like, randomization. But yeah, summary, we would probably just use what Ethereum uses.
Got it.
Yeah. All right. And then super quick, wrapping up. There's a couple of things, you know, you could say, oh, what about censorship resistance? You can actually argue that this is a really good design for censorship resistance, because only people who actually value proposing for a rollup will buy lottery tickets for it. So for example, if a proposer says, I don't want to have anything to do with a privacy focused rollup because it might have sanctioned stuff on it, they just won't buy the lottery ticket. And this means that the people who do win the sequencing rights are totally okay with sequencing for something that might have sanctions on it. So this actually helps censorship resistance, because you're not saying all rollups have to be sequenced by one party or none at all. You can allow parties that actually value each rollup the most. So like parties that are okay sequencing for something with sanctions, or maybe parties that are okay sequencing for a rollup that doesn't generate a lot of revenue. So this is good for censorship resistance. And then there's a couple of other caveats, but I'll kind of skip over those because I don't think they're quite as important. So the main point on this slide is that, I spent all of this time discussing this, and this is just our proposer assignment mechanism, but it's the biggest idea of this whole, what we're calling based espresso. But the second part I said is this finality gadget. And so where does this whole finality gadget fit in? Well, this is the espresso network. And going back to this slide, I said how you have this layer 1.5, and the natural question is, well, why do you have this extra layer in there? Why don't you just use the layer 1? So this is why. Remember that we want espresso to be based. So specifically this design with espresso, it doesn't force rollups to be based. It allows them to choose whether or not they want to be based. So being based, as kind of described in the initial ETH research post by Justin, the definition is that you allow the L1 proposer to propose for your rollup. That's what it is to be based. So in espresso, rollups can choose to be based and allow the L1 proposer to sequence for them, or they can choose not to. So that's the important part here, is that espresso offers a lot of customization. There's also the key point here, which is there is a fundamental trade-off between L1, L2 interoperability and fast finality. So the reason for this is that the L1 has slow finality and it can reorg. So if you're trying to do an atomic transaction between the L1 and the L2, and the L1 reorgs, well, then your transaction isn't atomic. So if you really want an atomic transaction with Ethereum, you have to wait for Ethereum finality to be sure that it's actually going to succeed. This is different than a lot of L2s today who choose fast finality. So they base their state off of some really old Ethereum block that's already finalized and will never reorg. And because of this, they can offer really fast finality. So this is the fundamental trade-off between being a based rollup and a non-based rollup. But the good thing is that what Espresso is doing, which we're calling ad hoc shared sequencing because it allows a lot of customization for rollups, is that it allows rollups to sit anywhere on this spectrum. So a rollup can say, I want to enable atomic interoperability between Ethereum and my rollup. They can choose that. And then another rollup also in the same Espresso network can say, no, I actually want fast finality and I don't care as much about interoperability with the L1. But there's a really interesting thing you can do here, which is you can actually take the customization and you can take it even further and you can allow it at the user level. Now, this gets a lot more complicated and there's a lot more questions that need to be answered. But the idea is that a user can say, I have a transaction that I want to be atomic with the L1. So I say you're okay to reorg this transaction if the L1 reorgs. But another user on the same rollup can actually say, well, my transaction has nothing to do with the L1, and so I want fast finality. And this is something that we're actively exploring at Espresso. It definitely makes things a lot more complicated because, you know, what happens if I have a transaction that relies on a transaction that also reorgs with the L1? Well, then mine kind of has to also reorg with the L1. So it gets complicated, but I think it's a really, really interesting open area of research that we're looking into, because basically it allows users to just have a lot of customization over what they do.
Does this split the lottery into like two separate lotteries where you're like bidding on, you're buying lottery tickets for specific transactions and not like the entire rollup bundle?
Yeah, that's a good question. It does not. So I think, well, one key fact I actually forgot to mention is, how does the L1 proposer actually end up in this whole like lottery? And there's a couple of ways you can do it. One is they can just participate in the lottery as a regular proposer. That doesn't currently work because the Ethereum proposers aren't known like far enough in advance. So that doesn't work. But basically the way we do it is that we allow the Ethereum proposer the right of first refusal. So whoever wins the lottery, the Ethereum proposer can say, hey, I'll pay you what you paid plus like some extra fee. And then I can always buy that off of you. So that's how we do it. But then back to your question, no, it doesn't. So the lottery is still on the per rollup basis. What this actually changes is just how the rollup executes transactions. So the rollup will say, oh, this transaction is supposed to reorg with this L1 block. This L1 block did in fact reorg out of the chain, so I'll throw it away. Whereas this transaction didn't. So the change to do this isn't at the lottery level, it's at like the execution level of the rollup.
And what would be like, what demand have you seen, or what anticipated demand have you seen for various types of basically on this trade-off of effectively security versus speed? Like, is there examples of like transactions which you may anticipate being more in the security column versus more in the speed column from like an average rollup user?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. So the classic example is a bridge. A bridge wants maximum security. And so they want to make sure. So for example, if you're doing a bridge between the L1 and an L2, you want to make sure that that's always atomic. There's never any chance that like one transaction could go through versus the other one not. So a bridge is where you want a lot of security. Something where you might be okay with, reorging might be something, maybe you're taking advantage of some arbitrage, and that arbitrage is with a centralized exchange and it only exists at a particular moment in time. So in that case, maybe you're okay with a reorg because you need your transaction to happen within like a certain real time amount. Let me think of some other examples. I think bridging is probably the best example. Although with bridging, going back to kind of this page right here, there with Espresso, you can actually do something quite interesting, which is normally with bridging, you would have to wait for Ethereum finality, which takes really long. But because you with Espresso, you can have this, the L1 proposer also proposing for the L2. They can enable this atomic transaction. So even if the L1 reorgs, the Espresso can actually say, okay, L1 reorg, so I'm going to throw out that transaction. And what this does is that even if your atomic transaction reorgs out, you're guaranteed that the promise never gets broken. So as an example, let's say you have a transaction between an L1 and an L2. The L1 transaction gets reorged, and Espresso will then make sure that that L2 transaction is dropped. So there's never a case where the L2 transaction succeeds and the L1 transaction doesn't. And if the L1 transaction succeeds, then due to the guarantees of Espresso, the L2 transaction will also always be included. So I think a key point here is that you can sit at either end of this spectrum, but you can still actually have a lot of safety, because the safety comes from having the same party sequence the transaction, so they know whether both are included or both aren't included. And then the safety also comes from the logic of Espresso, that it throws out transactions if they aren't included in the L1. I might not be explaining this in the most clear sense, but the point is that even if the L1 reorgs, with Espresso, you can do it in a way where the worst you get is a wasted time. Okay, you have to resubmit your transaction, but you never get a case where one fails and one succeeds. That was kind of a tangent off of your question. Hopefully
it makes sense. But it's important because also want to dive into kind of the entire consensus mechanism of Espresso itself, in terms of like how we're going to figure out the best way to decentralize that and make sure that bad boy stays up 24/7, no full liveness. But I'm sure that we can talk about that here shortly.
Oh yeah. Consensus is what I spend my most time on at Espresso. So really would love to talk about that. Yeah. I just have like one more slide left, which is basically Pre-confirmations. So I mentioned this briefly at the beginning, pre-confirmations. There's two kinds of pre-confirmations. Generally speaking, there's more, but the two, they mainly fall into two kinds. And they're a tester pre-confs and proposer pre-confs. Proposer pre-confs are basically where the proposer says, I promise to include this transaction when it's my turn. And a tester pre-confirmation is when you have a whole network of validators finalizing some transactions. So for example, when Espresso finalizes a transaction on the Espresso network, that's an attester preconf. And that means that that transaction cannot get reorged unless you break the fundamental safety assumptions of the Espresso network. So this would be like you have to slash one third of all stake if you ever wanted to reorg this transaction. And proposer preconfirmations can usually be, they're usually faster because they're just one party offering them. So you can get them in like a few milliseconds. A tester pre-confirmations require going through consensus on the Espresso network, but once you have them, they're incredibly, incredibly strong. So going back to the bridging example, if you wanted to bridge something, you might not want to trust only a proposer pre-confirmation because that's only backed by so much collateral, like 32 ETH, let's say. Whereas the Espresso pre-confirmation has the weight of all of the attesters in the Espresso network and has a lot of economic collateral behind it, similarly to like Ethereum. And therefore it's really, really strong. So you might say, okay, I'm not gonna wait for finality on Ethereum, but I can wait for finality on Espresso, which takes maybe 1 to 2 seconds. And then I have this really, really strong pre-confirmation guarantee. So that's it. Basically the point of this whole talk is that Espresso can do two things. We're running this lottery that allows rollups to receive back revenue from sequencing. So they get back their MEV revenue, they get back their sequencing revenue. And the whole idea is that rollups are never worse off participating in Espresso than they would be on their own. So they're either the same level, they either get the same revenue or more. And then finally, also we have this, what we're calling ad hoc shared sequencing, which means that each rollup and potentially in the future, each user can decide whether they want to be based or non-based and whether they want to reorg with the L1 or not. So yeah, that's like the gist, a long discussion, but I think it's a really, really exciting new direction for Espresso.
It's awesome. Mm-hmm. Really, really appreciate it. And I think we'll just pop you up here. And I feel like we talked a lot about what Espresso can do mm-hmm. in terms of this shared sequencer network. But I think for a lot of people still listening, including myself and maybe Rob, Espresso seems like this abstract magic box of like goodness that is just like this it's like all these really strong guarantees. But like, what is the consensus mechanism for Espresso? How does that kind of validation work? Who is making sure that Espresso stays up? And yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, this is great. Consensus is my favorite part of Espresso. So we have a consensus protocol that we call Hotshot. And this is a protocol that it can achieve pretty fast finality. So it's a BFT, Byzantine Fault Tolerant protocol. And in our benchmarks, we've been able to achieve finality, you know, between 1 to 2 seconds. It depends on how geo-distributed the network is and obviously the networking conditions, but that's generally how fast it can go. And that's pretty fast actually compared to a lot of protocols. We are planning on using restaking to secure the network. So all of the validators in the Espresso network would also be Ethereum validators that are staked in Ethereum. And because of this, we should be able to have quite a large amount of economic security even to start. And then the idea is that over time, you know, that will grow and grow, and our network can have economic security that's very comparable to the size of Ethereum, because obviously having really large economic security is really important. That's why people choose Ethereum over, you know, say other networks. So the validators are stakers in Ethereum. Our protocol also has a data availability aspect to it as well. So the reason is that if you're doing consensus, so to sequence transactions, you have to do consensus. That's like, you know, you need to have some way to have everybody decide that, yes, this is the sequence. Well, if you're already doing consensus, you actually can just get DA for free because DA is kind of a subset of doing consensus anyway. So not only does the Espresso protocol sequence transactions, it also does data availability on them as well, which is cool.
Yeah,
that, unknown, I think that underrated part of Espresso.
Yeah.
that follows real nicely from like where we left off on the slides, from proposer and a tester pre-confirmations, because mm-hmm. you mentioned how like if we were to kind of like use only the proposer pre-confirmations, we're only getting the economic security of one validator, like only 32 ETH. But if we use these attester pre-confirmations, we get the economic security of the entire Espresso network, which sounds like it's going to be more, it's going to be closer to like all of the restaked Ethereum that's like available in the economic security of Ethereum and not just like a single 32 ETH proposer. Right. So like let's say like I wanted to contribute to like the Espresso node network and I want to be like a validator or an attester on the Espresso protocol. Like mm-hmm. how would I go about doing that and contribute my own like economic security to the Espresso network?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think the best way is that once we integrate with EigenLayer, then you admittedly you do have to run your own Ethereum staker, which requires 32 ETH, which might be a little bit of a high barrier of entry. But we want to do that because we want to make sure that we have this really good economic security behind us. I think one also, so you can run your own home Ethereum validator and then you can restake using EigenLayer into Espresso. I think another thing, which isn't something we're like actively, this is kind of tangential to Espresso, but is like distributed validator technology. I'm personally quite interested in that.
So bullish.
And I think that that's like a great way too for people who don't have 32 ETH, but they still wanted to restake. I think it'll be really interesting to see these DVTs be able to restake on EigenLayer, and then someone with less than 32 ETH can also help secure the Espresso network. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
And I think it's super bullish to use like being an AVS means that you don't have to just inflate a potential token or in other example, a token emissions to the max for economic security. You can just, mm-hmm. you can just be like, yo, we have good tech. We can use Ethereum and bang. So
exactly.
I think we could talk for hours about how EigenLayer is like the biggest thing since sliced bread in crypto. Yeah. But Ellie, I think that I just would like to say, I really appreciate you coming on, learned quite a bit. Was already mega bullish on what you guys are building and even more so now. And I would like to just keep learning about just all these different options. And man, it's just very exciting. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
My closing thought here is like, I can't wait to explain cross-domain MEV to Larry Fink, because it seems like anyone who's like running this Citadel level TradFi operation is going to be so excited about cross-domain MEV arbitrage, like essentially arbitrage across all these rollups. Mm-hmm. And like, I just see that as a path to onboard like a new institutional wave. And that's only possible through interoperability solutions like shared sequencing.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.